through collaborative.org.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This week on The Connection, a special five-part series on presidential leadership, conflict, and character. Our series today shifts into the 20th century and straight into the First World War. Well, actually, it was not straight into that war. President Woodrow Wilson fought for several years to keep America out of Europe's fighting. As he campaigned for his second term in 1916, he ran under the slogan that, quote, "he kept us out of war." It was not to last. Just months after his inauguration, Wilson responded to increasing German submarine attacks and sent American soldiers overseas. His reluctant step onto the battlefield did, however, cement his long-standing determination to find a forum for global peace. His obstinate push for the League of Nations was in some ways the undoing of his office. Connection listeners, how do you measure the wartime leadership of Woodrow Wilson? Do you see his influence today on the presidency or on the country? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us again today, the professor of public policy at Harvard's JFK School of Government, David Gergen. David's with us through this week, using his own experience as an advisor to four presidents to help us gauge leadership and character. David's a professor of public service and director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Kennedy School. Also with us today, John Milton Cooper, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin and author of Breaking the Heart of the World, Woodrow Wilson and the Fight for the League of Nations. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you. John, before Mr. Wilson's fight for the League of Nations, he was fighting to keep America out of the First World War. And I'm always puzzled by that because in the early months of that war, you have such unbelievable carnage in the countries that were still so closely linked to the United States. That what was the basis of his push to keep America out of that battle?
Well, first of all, he's reflecting public opinion very much. The country didn't want to be in it. This was Europe's war. This country was based, at least for the European people of like us of European descent, who'd rejected Europe and come here. Another thing, too, remember, the country was divided. Among recent immigrants, one of the largest groups were German Americans, many of whom were either born in Germany or first generation in this country and had very strong ties to the Vaterland, as they called it. And so there's just a lot of reasons that we didn't want to be in the war. In fact, right down to 1917, majority sentiment was not in favor of it, not necessarily against it either by 1917, but very reluctant.
I wonder, David, if in looking back at that time, we should also take note of the fact that Wilson was himself a child of the Civil War. I mean, these things do link up. The memories of that war were still very much with the country.
The memories of that war were with the country, as were the memories of the instructions that George Washington gave as he left office. Remember, his farewell address urged us to remain neutral, to stay out of European wars. And Thomas Jefferson urged us to avoid entangling alliances. That was very much the tradition and history of the country. We had not entered in any foreign wars. There had been small skirmishes within the confines of the Monroe Doctrine. And Wilson, indeed, himself had sent troops into action in Central and Latin America before the First World War broke out. But the tradition, as John Milton Cooper has written, has been one of, up until that time, was one of isolation. And many, such as Teddy Roosevelt, believe that we should be much more internationalist. But the tradition and the sentiment in the country was very much in favor of isolation. I think there were some other elements that went to Wilson's personality about why he wanted neutrality. But certainly he was working within a long-held tradition in the United States.
I'm glad you brought up Teddy Roosevelt, because in May of 1915, when the Lusitania was sunk, and there was renewed pressure on Wilson to enter the war. I mean, there were 1,200 people who drowned in that ship, and only 128 of them were American. But I guess, John, at that moment, Teddy Roosevelt really turned on the heat on Woodrow Wilson. He called him almost a coward.
Oh, he did. Came right out and called him a coward. T.R. was not quite straightforward about saying we ought to be in the war. On the other hand, he called this an act of piracy. He came about as close as he could. The problem was the country didn't want to be in there. They had actually the closest thing to an instant public opinion poll right after the sinking of the Lusitania. A syndicate of New York newspapers had 1,000 editors from around the country, about every substantial paper in the country, telegraph in their opinion. And of those, out of 1,000, only 6 said we ought to go to war because of that. So Roosevelt is very much the hawk. He's very much pushing from that direction. But because of his personality, because of his influence and the rest of that, I think he seemed to be stronger than he was, to represent a stronger segment of opinion than he really did.
Hmm. I'm going to make sure we have our facts straight on the Lusitania, because I went back and tried to review this myself. The Lusitania was a British commercial liner.
That's right. The largest, since the Titanic had sunk, the largest passenger ship afloat.
Right. It was a large passenger ship, that largest, and it left the harbor of New York.
That's correct.
On the way to Europe.
Right.
And then a German U-boat sank it.
Right. Right off the coast of Ireland.
Right. And then there was a great, huge debate about whether there were munitions aboard.
The best we can tell, David, was that the Lusitania was carrying some rifles and some bullets and maybe a few other things, but not very much. Mm-hmm. I mean, the consequence of sinking the Lusitania was to kill a lot of people, you know, and the Germans kept claiming, oh, this was a British, but that was really very thin.
And the question was whether it violated our own rights for our citizens to go on the seas, the high seas, if we were a neutral country.
That's correct. No, the international law was that you had a right to do it and that any belligerents were supposed to make provision for passengers and crew, and, of course, the submarine didn't do that.
Right. Now, in January of 1917, Wilson made his peace without victory speech and spoke of the entangling alliances that he wanted every nation to avoid.
Yep. He's trying to turn Jefferson back on his head there, really.
and what is it? 3 months later, he stands up.
Less than 3 months later, about two and a half months.
He stands up with this unbelievable turnaround.
Well, except he didn't see it that way, because at one point in the war address he said, my objects are the same, says the Congress, my objects are the same as when I addressed you on 22nd January last. Wilson still wanted to try to build a permanent peace. He wanted to have a liberal, non-punitive settlement in Europe, and he wanted to have a League of Nations, an empowered League of Nations in which the United States would be a fully participating, charter, strong member there. And would, in fact, what he's trying to do with that entangling alliance is he's trying to work his way around Washington and Jefferson and the isolationist tradition.
Now, I know that you, John, have spoken of this particular speech as perhaps second only to Lincoln's second inaugural
I think it's the greatest presidential speech since the second
inaugural. Can I ask you to just read us the last three paragraphs of Woodrow Wilson's
delighted
speech?
Delighted to, Dick.
April 1917.
Yeah, just a introduction to it. The first part of the speech was actually very low-key, a recitation of everything that had gone along, and then gradually he warmed up to it and explained what the duty was. And this is the end of the speech.
What was the forum? Where was he to deliver this speech?
Joint session of Congress.
Okay.
Now, one other little interesting bit there, too. Wilson was the first president since John Adams to appear before Congress in person. He'd started doing this right after he was inaugurated. Jefferson had ended that practice because Jefferson had wanted to emphasize the separation
this
of powers.
This is the prime minister notion of
and Wilson wanted to break down the separation of powers, exactly.
Jefferson also, by the way, hated giving speeches.
That's true.
He was a very shy man. He liked to write. He only, in 8 years as president, he only gave 2 public speeches, his first inaugural and his second inaugural.
that's quite true, yes. But in the fashion of all orators of that time, and this too, he ended up with the final peroration. It is a distressing and oppressive duty, gentlemen of the Congress, which I have performed in thus addressing you. There are, it may be, many months of fiery trial and sacrifice ahead of us. It is a fearful thing to lead this great peaceful people into war, into the most terrible and disastrous of all wars, civilization itself seeming to be in the balance. But the right is more precious than the peace, and we shall fight for the things which we have always carried nearest our hearts, for democracy, for the right of those who submit to authority to have a voice in their own governments, for the rights and liberties of small nations, for a universal dominion of right by such a concert of free peoples as shall at last bring peace and safety to all nations and make the world itself at last free. To such a task, we can dedicate our lives and our fortunes, everything that we are and everything that we have, with the pride of those who know that the day has come when America is privileged to spend her blood and her might for the principles that gave her birth and happiness and the peace which she has treasured. God helping her, she can do no other.
And with that, America entered the First World War. David Gergen, the themes of birth and death and liberty that we've spoken about as recurring in the minds of great presidents are very present in what Wilson said.
They are indeed, and we were just talking about that yesterday with regard to Lincoln at Gettysburg. It did have that theme of life, death, and then rebirth of the nation. And Wilson is speaking. Wilson brings to the presidency an eloquence that had not been seen since Lincoln. I think he had the finest pen of any president in the 20th century. He had a lofty spirit. He was moved, as John has written, by his religious beliefs. He was, of course, raised as a Presbyterian. Strong, I think you call him a Presbyterian priest, is that?
Well, sort of.
Yeah. Close enough. Son of, yeah, right. Nephew of, grandson of, and married into a family of Presbyterian priests.
Exactly. Yep. And yet at the same time, in these very lofty ideals he sets forth, and making the world safe for democracy, as he called it, began to put forward a principle and a standard which would later prove to be his undoing. It was a moralistic approach to international affairs which didn't seem to fit the world in which he was living ultimately.
David, Wilson was actually this rap of the idealist on him. Mm-hmm. It's true. I mean, the man was an idealist. He said he was and mm-hmm. proclaimed it. On the other hand, he was awfully circumspect about it, and that safe for democracy. In the speech, he actually says the world must be made safe for democracy. And as you said, he had this eloquent pen. I mean, this is the most punctilious stylist, except for Lincoln and Jefferson, we've had as president. If he used the passive voice, he did it deliberately. Mm-hmm. And what he meant was, we can't make the world safe for mm-hmm. democracy. We can try. We can do our part. We can get in there. And he was very, very circumspect about it. And then his great 14 points address actually is very, those are very specific things. He doesn't use the term self-determination in there. That actually, Lloyd George coined that, and Wilson later picked it up. It was too good not to use, but he never proclaimed self-determination as a universal principle to be applied everywhere. It had to be applied selectively where the circumstances permitted.
You made a much closer reading of Wilson than I have, and I defer to your judgment on that. Certainly, the impression that was created for many, whether he said it or not, was that it was a war intended to make the world safe.
That's correct,
for democracy.
Yes.
And there was a great deal of disillusionment which followed that war because, of course, democracy did not break out. The number of democracies in the world actually went down between the First World War and the Second World War. And in that sense, the Wilsonian ideal has been a major tradition of American foreign policy that I think was there before, but he gave voice to it, this idealism in American foreign policy. And it's one of the most important legacies he contributed was to give voice to it and to bring it to the forefront of our thinking. But we have in fact been dancing and wrestling with that ever since. So where does idealism start and stop?
That's right. We have.
When we come back, we'll talk about the armistice. We'll talk about the peace conversations that came after that and Woodrow Wilson's role in those. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, our conversation about presidents at wartime, conflict, and character. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. With me on the program today, John Cooper, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin, author of Breaking the Heart of the World, Woodrow Wilson and the Fight for the League of Nations, also author of Warrior and the Priest, Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt. Interesting, fascinating time in American history. David Gergen's with us. He's a professor of public service and director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. His book, I Witnessed Power, The Essence of Leadership, talks about the time that he spent telling four different U.S. presidents what they ought to do, or at least giving them advice on what they ought to do.
How often I failed.
John, let's back up a little bit and put some a bit of a basis on this Woodrow Wilson mm-hmm. fellow. I mean, it's hard not to go straight at the,
sure.
his high points, but he was an academic. How else do you describe him as distinct or different from other presidents?
Well, first of all, he's the only professional academic we've ever had. I'm sorry, it's going to sound like a plug for my own profession. David's been in and out of it. I've spent all my life just in academia. Wilson was one of the leading political scientists, academic political scientists of his generation, and I think would rank among the five or six greatest in American history. He studied how power worked. You know, it sounds simplistic, but he wanted to know how power really worked.
And do you go back to the time when he was a professor and look at his writing
from
that
time? Yeah. Because it's what's important about that is this is a man who got a chance to put his ideas into action. I like to say I don't know any other career in American history, and I can't think of one in any other nation's history which really vindicates and recommends the study of politics as a preparation for the practice of politics. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a man who took the ideas. It's not coincidental that he happened to have been an academic and a college president and then became a politician. He put it right in there. Dick, earlier you mentioned the prime ministerial idea. Wilson liked to compare our system with the parliamentary system, and he saw advantages in the parliamentary system that he wanted to try to adapt to our system. And he said the president must be a prime minister. And one of the things he did was he stressed party leadership, you know, that sort of unsung and unloved institution of ours. But he was a real party. He was a theorist of party government who then put it into practice.
And in fact, if you look at what he was able to accomplish, David, in the years before he became consumed with the First World War, you look at the 16th Amendment, the 17th Amendment, the repeal of Civil War era tariffs, the creation of the Federal Reserve, the Federal Trade Commission. He did all this at a time when, as John rightly points out, the partisan nature of the politics was all around him.
He did indeed. And his first term, I think, is one of the most remarkable in American history. His legislative achievements in Congress have been rivaled in the 20th century only by Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson. And had he only been a one-term president, he might well have gone down in history as one of our most successful presidents. There is a sense that perhaps John disagrees with. There is a sense of parallel between Lyndon Johnson and Woodrow Wilson in the sense that both had enormous legislative achievements. Wilson did win a war, but lost the peace and to a significant degree. And Lyndon Johnson, of course, lost a war. And there's – you remember Eric Goldman, the historian, mm-hmm. wrote a book about Lyndon Johnson called The Triumph and the Tragedy, A Portrait of Johnson. And there's a quality about Wilson that seems to me
actually, David, I don't disagree with you there at all. By the way, Goldman was one of my professors in college.
Oh, he was.
I liked him very much. Wilson said shortly after he was elected, he was talking to one of his friends from the Princeton faculty, and he said it would be an irony of fate if my administration had to deal chiefly with foreign affairs. He went on to say all my preparation has been in domestic affairs. He wanted to be and planned to be a domestic president, and foreign affairs caught up with him quite early, in fact, even before the First World War.
He was a great progressive president.
But he had some problems, though. I mean, he had people in his administration who brought Jim Crow right into the federal government.
Well, what they tried
to. I don't know
how
accurate that is.
No, that's true. No, they tried to. Wilson's the first, except for Grover Cleveland, is the first Democratic president since the Civil War. And very much his base was in the South. He was a Southerner, Southern expatriate himself. Many of his cabinet members were Southerners. There's a sense of Southern, white Southern restoration about the Wilson administration. And some of them said they thought segregation, to introduce it in the federal workplace, would be a great idea. And Wilson had a very collegial approach. He let cabinet members do their own thing within reason. He said, well, okay, give it a try. And what happened then, the newly founded NAACP and certain politicians, my own state Senator La Follette, raised a great hue and cry. So they pulled back on it. They never did actually introduce it, but he tried to. And it's a shameful thing.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Wellesley, Massachusetts. Dave is joining us. Hello, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. My grandfather, Newton D. Baker, was the Secretary of War in the Wilson administration during the war years.
Wow.
And I've read a lot about that. I'm afraid I didn't know him personally. But the one comment I wanted to make was that picking him was a very clever stroke of casting against type. He was... very unimposing figure, my grandfather.
He was not a military man, David?
He was not a military man at all. He was about 5'6". He'd previously had a political career as the mayor of Cleveland, a progressive reform mayor. He was short and wore little round glasses and puffed on his pipe and looked the part of a college professor. And I think in present-day terms, he would be described as a liberal and a pacifist. And Wilson turned to him to lead the war effort.
It's David, it's part of what we've spoken about on previous programs, the art and the genius in finding the right people in the administration. It sounds like Wilson certainly had that.
He did, by and large. I'd be interested in Professor Cooper's views of his secretaries of state and whether they were the men that he might have wanted. And you know, went from Bryan, William Jennings Bryan,
right,
who resigned basically over the movement toward war, and then he went to Robert Lansing. And whether Lansing was the right man at the right time, I'm not sure. But I do think that Wilson, by and large, did surround himself with good people. We've seen that in Washington. We've seen that now in Lincoln. And by the way, there's another parallel between Wilson and Lincoln, and that is he would not have been elected had it not been a multi-party race, a multi-candidate race.
The third candidate.
Yes, he was again another minority elected figure because the Republican Party in this case broke up. The Democratic Party had broken up when Lincoln ran in 1860. In this case, the Republican Party broke up. And, of course, Teddy Roosevelt, having run against Taft for the nomination, then ran on the Bull Moose ticket. And Taft came in third, and Wilson came in first, but he also came in with a minority of the country behind him.
He came in with less than 50% of the popular vote, right?
42%.
42%, wasn't it?
On the secretaries of state, that's the one case, well, after Bryan, that's the one case where Wilson didn't practice this collegial approach. He became his own secretary of state. He and Bryan actually had worked together fairly well up to that point. Bryan got it because he was the premier Democrat. It was his job to refuse. And Bryan also did have some reputation in foreign affairs. But with Lansing, Wilson let Colonel House talk him into appointing Lansing because Lansing wouldn't be a big man, and House said, you know, you want to be your own Secretary of State, and he did. I mean, and I think that is a flaw. I think he dominated foreign affairs too much. I think he took too much on himself and didn't train, you know, a corps of trusted lieutenants. If I could say something about Newton Baker that is interesting, he almost became vice president and might almost have been president, in fact. In 1916, Colonel House and some other Democrats led a move to drop the quite lackluster Vice President Thomas Riley Marshall. The only thing America needs is a good 5-cent cigar, is what he said, and replace him with Newton Baker.
Still do.
and Baker, Wilson's reaction to it was he was intrigued with the idea, but he said, no, I can't spare Baker. I need him where he is. If Baker had been Vice President when Wilson had his stroke in 1919, I think things might have been very different.
They might have, in fact, deferred to the vice president
exactly.
there
instead
and of Mrs.
And
Wilson.
And Wilson might actually have stepped aside if he'd had an able, trusted vice president like Baker.
It's interesting.
Can I add to that?
Sure. Please.
David, go ahead. Is that in the family album, by the way?
I'm flipping through it right now. In 1932, Walter Lippmann led a movement to have Newton Baker nominated for president by the Democratic Party. But the Roosevelt camp made sure that didn't happen.
William Randolph Hearst had a role in that, too. He was
absolutely
dead set against your grandfather becoming president.
Talking about Wilson and his neutrality and being paying close attention to the public, Wilson did not have the political comfort or margin that one would ordinarily like in a president, coming in with less than 50% of the vote. After a very successful legislative agenda in his first term, he faced a really stiff reelection fight. He almost lost his reelection. In fact, his opponent went to bed the night of the election thinking he'd won. And Wilson squeaked it out in California and squeaked it back into the presidency. So he was never that far above. As a leader, it would have been difficult for him to be too far out in front of the public, given his weak political base.
Was that in part his undoing, I wonder?
I think part of it. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say before we get to that, I should ask you, John, to describe the moment that Wilson went to Europe after the armistice. I mean, the descriptions of that time and the way that he was feted by the whole world.
Oh, it's a triumphal tour. He decided, against the advice of Lansing and some others, to head the American delegation to the peace conference. He left right after giving his speech to Congress, the opening of the session of Congress in December 1918. And except for a short trip back at the end of February and beginning of March in 1919, he was gone. He was out of the country until early July. We've never had a president gone for that long, abroad that much. When he got to Europe, what he wanted to do was get right into the peace conference. Well, they weren't ready for it. So he had to go around, somewhat reluctantly went around on a tour of the Allied capitals, Paris, Rome, London, Brussels. And it was just this incredible outpouring. And even between the cities, people would line up along the train tracks to watch his train go by, and the cheering. It was an incredible moment. You know, one historian's called it America's moment, when it looked as if we held the destiny of the world in our hands, or Wilson held them in his hands.
Was that the apex of Wilson's time? Did he misconstrue perhaps some of that to thinking that he could turn that support into support for his League of Nations?
I don't think so. Anybody's head is turned somewhat by adulation, but he also realized that he had a tough fight there. He did seize upon it, though. It's interesting, David, you're quite right about his narrow political base, but his reaction to that was not, well, gee, I'll have to go slow and be careful. He's very bold. In fact, one thing that fascinates me is he is, in fact, a much bolder president than Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt's actually the one who's cautious and careful about doing things. Wilson's the one who, when he's got a choice between playing it safe or making a small step or doing a big one, he's got that gambler's instinct to do that. When he saw that, he thought, okay, I'm going to try to get the League of Nations. And he hammered together the covenant of the League of Nations in about working with a small group, really only two other people, Lord Robert Cecil and Jan Smuts, in about 3 weeks.
But what a long time to be away home and the domestic agenda.
Yeah. Well, the most fascinating question about his leadership does come at the end of the war. Getting into the war and getting the people committed, he really got the country committed. And I don't think there's any question that in retrospect, the arrival of American troops helped to save Paris and did change the war psychologically. We didn't fight all that much, but the arrival of American troops and the fact that we were going to bring our munitions on, I think, really did change the mind of the Germans about whether they could win it or not. And that really was that was a triumph for him. The really interesting questions about his leadership, though, come after the war is over, when he does go to Europe in this triumphal procession, and then looks for his 14 points, looks to build a League of Nations, and how do we judge what happened then? Was it idealism that we should salute, or was it a man who made the perfect the enemy of the good? Whether he could have come out with something better had he approached it differently.
Let's see if we can go back to our callers for just a minute. First of all, thanks to David for calling in, and to Boston now, and James. Maybe right on this point, eh?
Yes. Well, Wilson is always depicted as an idealist, but wasn't it really the so-called realpolitik of the French that brought ruined the peace? I mean, the vindictiveness of the Versailles Treaty, and you were talking about Lincoln yesterday. I mean, he offered the South very good terms, you know, with malice toward none and all of that. He understood that in victory one had to be humble and try to rebuild. Relations, whereas the French, with their realism, really set the stage for fascism, didn't they?
John?
I'd agree and disagree with that. You're quite right that Wilson wanted a milder peace. He didn't want to be as harsh and vindictive, although he came around after a while thinking the Germans needed to take their medicine and be punished. There's a new book by Margaret Macmillan called Paris 1919, and I think she makes the excellent point that in some ways, we have chewed over that Paris Peace Conference and the terms of the Treaty of Versailles too much, that the fault lay not in whether that peace was too mild or too harsh, what these people did or didn't do in Paris in 1919, but what happened afterward. The thing is, the will was not there among the victors to maintain that peace. The will was not there, or the acceptance was not there among the vanquished, the Germans.
And the longer it spun out, the worse it got.
And what happened was, one by one, starting with us, the United States, the victors bugged out on it, showed that they were not committed to doing the things that were necessary to keep that peace.
Well, there is a There is a clash, though, as Wilson goes to Europe, between the new world, the idealism that Wilson represents, and the old world, the balance of power, politics, the sort of the grimier, muscular kind of sense of, you know, power makes all the difference. So in Wilson, there's a quote that I always love when Wilson goes to with his 14 points in triumph, and Georges Clemenceau, who was the tiger of France, responds that even God Almighty gave us only 10, and we broke those. And that old world view, what has recently been called the old Europe, did clash with what Wilson was seeking. And there's no question that the view of those, the Allies in France and Britain, this is not just French, and Britain, on war reparations did prevail, and it was in that sense. It was punitive. It was intended to be punitive. People wanted to hold down the Germans, and they wanted to strip them of the capacity. And I think that for many in international affairs today, that was the object lesson coming out of that war. The failure of that peace was what convinced Franklin Roosevelt, who worked for Wilson, to construct the United Nations and have a different kind of peace after it was over, to reject the counsel of someone like Hans Morgenthau about keeping down the Germans again, because it had not worked before. It is what flowed in the years that followed from the agreements opened the door to the Second World War.
David, To me, I'm not going to stick up for Clemenceau. And by the way, there were Americans who thought the same way.
Right.
Wilson's principal antagonist in the fight over the League of Nations, Henry Cabot Lodge, was completely on that wavelength. Say something about Senator Lodge in his hometown here. But the problem for the Germans was not the terms of the treaty. The problem for them was that they'd lost the war, and they simply did not accept that. There's been a good bit, in fact, a number of economists have gone back and those terms are actually the economic terms were not that harsh on the Germans. They're not as harsh, for example, as they had imposed on France after the Franco-Prussian War. Now, I know it's a matter of perceptions, exactly.
Right. I want to stop just for a minute and say that we'll come back and talk more about Woodrow Wilson and his idealism after the break. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
I'm writing to say that I'm still alive and well. There's some fine big boys from Tipperary somewhere in front of me. So cheer up, dear, the next time you hear I'll be somewhere in Germany.
Major funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And this is the third in our series of five-part series looking at presidents at wartime. Woodrow Wilson, the First World War. We've been talking about his work at the peace delegation in Europe. And then there was the ceremonial signing of the Treaty of Versailles in late June 1919. And bringing all this back home, John Cooper, was in many ways his undoing. I think of it now and look at it now as almost like the death of a thousand cuts that he suffered.
It's a tragedy. It really is. He had his work cut out for him. The senators were already very much aligned. It was clear he did not have anywhere near the two-thirds necessary for consent the way he wanted it, essentially without reservations. The question then was, what kind of reservations would we attach to it? Senator Lodge wanted some very severe reservations, which would have restricted our membership in the League.
Where did he go wrong? Did he misjudge what he was going to be able to do with Congress? Was he too idealistic?
I don't think it was that so much. The misjudgment, I think, was that he was perhaps pushing too hard for too much and not finding the right ground for compromise. I think one of the intriguing might have been is if he had not suffered that stroke, whether there was a chance that he would have come around, that he was having to negotiate in a bad situation. He was trying to keep the strongest position he could.
That he was taking the case to the people.
He took
when
the case to the people.
Right?
That's right. This is something he believed in. He believed in appealing over the heads of legislators. He'd done this in New Jersey when he was governor. He'd done it once before on behalf of military preparedness in early 1916. He wanted to do this. It was also a way of stirring up a fire behind them. And for all of their lodge and others said, it'll make no difference. We are taking a stand on principle. In fact, they were following the headlines and were very concerned about this. They were reading. We didn't have polls then, but they were reading the equivalent of those. Mm-hmm. And if a healthy Wilson had come back from that tour in showing his political strength and then willing to try to it really came down to Article 10, the collective security feature. Somehow there's been some way to square lodges wanting to keep basically a complete American sovereignty there as to what we would or wouldn't do with some kind of obligation. I mean, it was a very difficult thing to do, but it might have happened. But once Wilson suffered the stroke, then the personality consequences on him for that. He becomes so intransigent that he's really the one who blocks it in the end.
And David, these men are arguing about the identity of the nation. They're not just arguing about an Article 10. This is one of the fundamentals that we started with in Washington and we still talk about today.
They were arguing and to a significant degree about the sovereignty of the nation. Where does security rest? Where does the decision ultimately rest when the United States wants to get into conflict? Should it rest in a collective, as Wilson thought was imperative for all nations? Should there be an effect? Does that make the world safer for democracy, or does it rest by keeping ultimate sovereignty in the hands of the Congress and the President, as the Constitution originally envisioned? And we're wrestling with that question today. That's at the heart and soul of what we're facing right now in the United Nations and as we go forward in Iraq and in the post-Iraq world. So that has been a continuing theme as America has become an internationalist power over the course of the last 100 years or so. There is an additional question about Wilson as leader that arises in the context of trying to get this passed. And that is, when you're a leader and you feel very strongly that it's in the nation's interest to do something large, should you persist and reject compromise, or should you compromise and get less than the full loaf? Bill Clinton faced this on the health care plan that he put forward just 10 years ago. He went for broke. And refused to compromise and wound up with nothing. And Wilson, in effect, not only didn't want to compromise with Lodge, which was totally understandable because the Lodge reservations were so severe, but there were a group of senators who might have been available to him with softer reservations, mm-hmm. with more modest reservations. And I'm really curious about Professor Cooper's view on whether he would have been better to compromise or not, or what the lessons of leadership here are.
David, I think in the summer of 1919, he made some missteps. He actually negotiated with the senators. He spent 2 months meeting with them individually, doing the kind of patient wheedling and everything that he's accused of not doing. Then the other thing he did was he appeared before the Foreign Relations Committee. I think it's only two or three times in American history that a president, and what he did, he got around, he didn't go down to Capitol Hill to do it, but he invited them to the White House. But essentially he submitted himself for 3 hours of questioning, and often quite hostile questioning, because some of those senators on the Foreign Relations Committee, not only Lodge, were hostile to the League and hostile to Wilson. He did that.
But didn't he essentially say no to compromise
danced around that. I think that's where he missed it, though. I think the mild reservationist, I think if he'd made a deal with them early and staked out a position there, that would have put Lodge on the defensive, and that's where I think he blew it.
Let me stop you if I can. I want to try and let some of our callers in from Baton Rouge, Louisiana now. Steve's called in. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Hey, I got a question for the doctors. Very interesting discussion. How did President Wilson, as a political academic, reconcile Hamilton and Madison's arguments in Federalist Papers 16 through 24, specifically outlining why confederacies of any kind have failed from antiquity right on up to their time? How did Wilson reconcile that when he went to form the United Nations? Or the League of Nations.
This better not be on the exam.
Boy, you're taking me back. I have to get my copy of the Federalist out to read those. What he was trying to do was the best thing the best thing he thought was available, a kind of confederacy there. You're quite right. There were all kinds of hedges in that. Even in his league plan, not only did the great powers have a veto, but all the members of the council did. So you had to have unanimity in the council. There were any number of those. He believed that simply this was the best that could be gotten. The French had actually wanted a much stronger league with an international army. In other words, they were willing to have a super state to do this, and Wilson knew that this simply wouldn't fly. So it's a matter of doing the best you can. So in a sense, he was compromising there.
All right, Steve, thanks for your call.
Okay.
I wonder if we should turn the heat up a little bit under President Wilson here, because when you look at the Palmer raids, you look at the abrogation of civil rights, I think in particular of the arrest of Eugene Debs, many times a man who ran for president, a socialist, if I'm not mistaken, jailed 10 years for speaking out against Wilson?
No, he was in jail for about...
His sentence was 10 years.
Sentence was 10 years. He served about 2 years, 2 to 3 years. The repression was terrible. And the irony here is that Wilson gave out a famous talk, or it came out later, he unburdened himself to the editor of the New York World about how terrible it was going to be to go into the war and the awful consequences, including the consequences for civil liberties. And the most eloquent argument against going into the war was made by the man who took us in. The repression is something that, in some ways, Wilson, I think, feared a half-hearted commitment. And again, I think this is where his collegiality, his delegation also served him badly, because a number of the people who carried it out, such as the Postmaster General Burleson, were very heavy-handed and I think rather mean-spirited people who went after this. Now, with Eugene Debs, that's a little bit different. Debs wanted to go to jail. Debs martyred himself. He tried and tried and tried. He kept giving these speeches, and... the Justice Department's orders were leave him alone. And finally, what happened was a zealous U.S. attorney in Ohio, against the recommendation of the Justice Department, went ahead and prosecuted Debs. And then at the trial, Debs wouldn't let his lawyers mount a defense. I mean, Debs wanted to go to jail. He made a martyr of himself. Yeah.
Now, my understanding of the way that history looks back on presidents is that history is inclined to favor the accomplishments rather than the failures of presidents. And yet when history looks back on Wilson, it focuses more on failure than achievement. Was it the failure of the League of Nations? Was it the legacy of the civil rights abuses, David? Do you have any idea? Can you sort of put your finger on what took this president off the tracks as far as the historians are concerned? President Company may be excluded.
I'm not an historian, so I can't speak for them, but I don't think it was the repression that has stood out in this presidency. After all, the suspension of civil liberties has been a frequent feature of American life, sadly, from the Alien and Sedition Acts early in the history. When we go back now and celebrate John Adams, we don't really talk a lot about the Alien and Sedition Acts.
Didn't hurt Roosevelt.
But you have Roosevelt with the Japanese, and that was the way we dismissed the whole idea of accepting Jews from Europe, I think, is a chapter now that's coming back to haunt more and more. And you look at Lincoln with the suspension of habeas corpus, which he had to do in Maryland in order to let the troops get through. He had to keep order. So that, I think, that's been frequent. And Wilson, Wilson, I think, is ranked among the near great presidents.
Yep.
Historians have tended to put three presidents, Washington, Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt, in the top tier. And Wilson just below that, along with Jefferson and Teddy Roosevelt, and some would argue Truman, and Andy Jackson. But Wilson ranks right up there. But I don't think Americans fully appreciate the accomplishments of Wilson as a progressive. Mm. And the reforms he brought into play were extraordinarily significant for much of the 20th century. And even now, of course, the Federal Reserve is controversial. But it has been one of our most important institutions. And there have been other institutions where Wilson understood and represented that progressive tradition and said, we don't in this country, when we have economic problems, when the markets don't work, we don't take over companies, we regulate them. And that's a very different tradition from continental Europe. And I think Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt, that progressive tradition was, in by my way of thinking, one of the most important contributions, along with his idealism.
Is this a success, though, of leadership, or is this a success of administration, or should we make a distinction
I think
between
the two? Well, I, again, I'm not the expert that John is, but I believe it was a success of leadership in pushing forward on his domestic agenda. I do think he gets much lower marks for the fact that the peace didn't hold, and he shares in the blame for that, although there are many other factors that go into that.
I've always thought there are two ways of judging presidents and the greatness scale there. One, of course, is the one we all use and must use, is accomplishment. And the big three, Washington, Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt, on the scale of accomplishment are up at the top. Wilson, I think, comes off very well on the scale of accomplishment. The other thing I've always been intrigued with is, what does this person, he and someday she, bring to and give to the office? And to me there, the more problematic figure, I think, in that than Wilson is Theodore Roosevelt, mm-hmm. because he didn't accomplish a lot. He really didn't. But he gave so much to that office. He elevated the office. He brought intellect. He brought literary grace to it. And Wilson did this, too, and this academic background and this incredible political mind that he had. And
did he change the office, John?
I think he did, yeah, because for one thing, we haven't had a president who sends messages to Congress anymore. Now, one of the things he did, though, he used going to joint sessions the way that presidents now use appearing on television, first radio and then television. Mm-hmm. This was a way of reaching the American public. I think it's something he understood very well. I think his use of party government too is something that ought to be revived. And finally, for all the problems of treating your cabinet like responsible adults, I think there's a model of presidential leadership there which, to my mind, compares rather favorably to the usual one, which is FDR, LBJ, which is a bit of a bully,
and
a meddler.
I agree with that, but I want to speak to this other element about even though it didn't work in the end, in many respects. Elevating the ideals of what America is about and what our purposes in the world are was a very important contribution to our conduct of international policy in the years that followed. And I think a number of presidents have come to understand in the end. I mean, Henry Kissinger started out as believing in the other school, the realpolitik, the balance of power. Henry Kissinger has come around to the view that you cannot conduct a policy based on realpolitik alone, that there has to be this heavy entwinement of Wilsonian idealism. And I think that Wilson did contribute that.
Yeah, I agree. And George Kennan is someone who has come around again the same way, kind of new appreciation of Wilson.
A new appreciation of Wilson. Connection listeners, we continue our series on presidents in wartime, conflict and character tomorrow with a look at Franklin Delano Roosevelt, World War II. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. Coming up on Here and Now at noon, a debrief from Baghdad as